book lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the entire world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. And if you're like me, and you get tired of seeing the same old titles on every bestseller list, you're in the right place, because on this show, you'll hear from authors who aren't famous yet, but probably will be. Remember, you heard them here first. Today on my show, Barr Friedmantel and her debut novel, Honeysuckle. This is a dark fantasy about love and power, autonomy and consent. If you loved Frankenstein, you will love Honeysuckle, trust me. Later in the hour on our Book Biz segment, we'll talk to Ron Charles, former book editor and reviewer at The Washington Post. We'll be talking all about the current state of literary criticism and what we might find in the future. But like I said, we're going to start with Barr Friedmantel, author of Honeysuckle. Barr, welcome to the show. I am so excited to have you on Check This Out.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So your debut novel, Honeysuckle, first of all, it's completely twisted, unhinged, and I absolutely loved it.
Thank you.
I describe it as a twisted fairy tale in all the best ways. And it's truly wild. And I don't even really often know how to introduce it to people. So I thought that I would start by asking you to read for us and just take us into this world before we dive into talking about the book.
That sounds perfect. So I'm going to read a bit from the first chapter. I'll give just a bit of a setup so it'll make sense. So it starts with a lonely boy who's called Rory, who is basically annoying his older sister so much that she decides to create a playmate out of flowers just so he'll leave her alone. And this is the moment where she creates this playmate. So Rory didn't know how this transformation from pal to girl happened. His sister's hands flashed too fast to follow, weaving over, under, turning and entwining, glimmers of white fingers rising and falling among soft petals and supple branches. She was muttering a steady string of words, but whenever Rory tried edging close enough to hear, she drew him back, sending him for white flowers from the far edge of the meadow, for a handful of moss and honeysuckle vines from the forest, for an old dress from the attic. All the while, a girl made of flowers was taking shape under her hands. Finally, Wynne sat on her heels and looked at the creation arrayed in front of her, doll perfect and Rory-sized. She looked just like a girl, fast asleep in the tall summer grass. Yet somehow, the impression of blossoms lingered in the pansy roundness of her cheeks and in the petal-like suppleness of her skin, and the shadow of ivy seemed to curl in the tendrils of her golden hair, despite her looking nothing like vines or flowers at all. There was a self-satisfied twist to Wynne's mouth. Rory's eyes were round with wonder. "Wake up," she told the flower girl. And the flower girl opened her eyes and smiled.
That was Barr Friedmantel reading from her debut novel, Honeysuckle. And we just heard about how Day, this one of the main characters, was created. She's a flower girl. So Barr, can you tell us, how do you describe this book? What is Honeysuckle about?
Okay, so I think the most, like, best way to describe it is a very loose retelling of a story from Welsh mythology. And it's about a girl made out of flowers who must be rewoven at the end of each season or she'll fall apart, and a lonely boy who will do anything to stop the cycle of bloom and decay, including a lot of things he really, really shouldn't.
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty accurate, because I also say it's a little bit of a fairy tale, a little bit of love, a little bit of fiction, right? Like, I also wasn't really sure. But at its heart, it's about a flower girl who comes to life. It's an alternate universe. So you have this sort of twisted retelling of this Welsh myth or fairy tale. That's sort of the factual description of what it's about. But to you, what is it really about? I mean, why retell this myth and this story of a flower girl who needs to come back to life every season?
There are two things it's about, or like two things that made me want to tell the story. And I think the first is just really, really loving the myth, the story of Blodeuwedd from the Mabinogion. And I think Honeysuckle was born from this tension of loving this myth and going back to it again and again for years and feeling really, really uncomfortable. Like, I'll give just the Cliff Notes version. The story of Blodeuwedd is about a girl made out of flowers to be a wife of a hero that is cursed not to be able to take a human wife, so it's a way to bypass the curse. And she's later turned into a bird as punishment for choosing a different life for herself. And she's very much framed as the villain of the story. It's not that she's not making a lot of very questionable choices, but still, she had so little autonomy and so little, like, say, and her body kept being changed, like, without her having, like, first she's created and then she's punished. And the lack of bodily autonomy coupled with the fact that she is framed as the villain and, like, her husband is framed as the hero really, really didn't sit well with me. So I really wanted to explore this tension and really think about what it means to be created for someone, what it means to have your life hinge on someone else. And I think more personally, I was very, I found myself at that time really thinking about what it means to be in a relationship where the power was skewed and what kind of, like, a normal everyday relationship, what kind of ripples it sends when the balance is not 50-50, because I feel like no relationship, no matter how perfect, is always 50-50 on the long run, because things shift and sometimes it's subtle and sometimes it's very radical, and really explore what it means to have less power in a relationship or to have more power even if you don't want it. And rethinking about the story of Blodeuwedd was a way to explore this.
So Blodeuwedd, this Welsh myth that your debut novel Honeysuckle is based on, is like your novel then really about this power and who's in control. Because at its core, right, we have the character Day and her makers, Rory and Wynn, brother and sister, and then Rory, who's the brother who becomes obsessed with her and obsessed with making her live longer and her body. And at first he's a little kid and they're growing up together, but he is always in control. When does Day become her own person? Can we talk about that? Let's talk about her evolution.
I think part of what the novel asks is exactly this, like, what do you need to become your own person or to be deserving, to have the right to consent to things, to be considered as something autonomous? And I don't think there's a clear-cut answer. I can give you my answer, is that she was always a person, or she's not a person, but she was always deserving the same right for autonomy and consent as a person. But that the process of realizing that she wants something different than her life in relation to Rory, to be something different than his friend, his companion, the thing she's created for, takes her a while. And he must be sort of a way for her to ask herself, what is he when he's not around? Because at some point he goes to university to try and find a way to extend her life, and she's left there all alone. And she has to figure out, like, what is he when he's not around? And I think this is when the process really starts. But if you ask me, she was deserving to all the rights of a person from the beginning.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. And I'm talking to Bar Friedmantel about her debut novel, Honeysuckle. It is unhinged, twisted in all the amazing ways. It is about a flower girl, Day. She's literally created from flowers in this alternate universe and turned magically into a girl, a playmate for Rory. And Rory becomes obsessed with her. They're just little children. They're, I think, 8 years old when they first get started, or she's about, you know, built to be like an eight-year-old. And then he starts to grow up and he falls in love with her romantically. And he starts changing her body so that she looks like a woman and so that they can be together, right, sexually. And that's where this starts to get a little bit crazy and why we're talking about these issues of consent, right? So if she is made, he is completely in control of her future, whether or not she lives or dies as the season changes. Does she have any ability to consent? That's this big question here, right? Can you have consent if you have no power in a relationship? What do you think, Bar? How do you approach that in this book?
I think the way I approach it is by not having an answer. Like, having a lot of questions and trying to hoping that readers will have a debate and form their own answers rather than me forcing my opinions on them. And I think it's something about me as a reader. I love it when I get to decide for myself how I think and not to be told what I should be feeling or thinking or what conclusions I'm supposed to draw. But also, I really don't have answers because this is such a complicated question. Where is the line? Like, how much power do you need in order, like, to be able to consent? When do you stop being able to consent? It's so nebulous and it's so invisible. And, like, you can pass this line without even noticing because it happens in such slow increments that I think there's no way to say, okay, you need this much power in order to be able to say yes. It's something we have to ask ourselves all the time in relationships. Like, am I able to consent right now? Do I feel safe to say no?
Yeah. And so that's fascinating in and of itself in your debut novel, Honeysuckle. But you can extrapolate and take that to bigger situations, right, of consent. It's not just between a couple. I mean, you're born into a family. Are you consenting to your family rules? You know, you go through a school system. Do you consent to those? Are there ways you can break out, right? I mean, there are bigger questions here. And you examine it from a very tiny lens. And we could spend all day talking about that. But what really appealed to me was this bigger question. You know, and for me, when I look at, for example, having my own children, I mean, in a sense, I created them. But do I actually have any control over them? I mean, at this point, no. They're their own person. But when did they become their own people? Right? These are big questions that your debut novel, Honeysuckle, really, really pulled out for me. Have you been talking about these bigger issues, or are you really only focused on the relationship in the book? Like, how do you think about it?
Oh, I think about it as something that it happens in relationships in general, not the one in the book, but everyone we have. It can be romantic, it can be friendship, it can be family. I think, like, the issue of consent is inherently, for me, the way I look at it, as something that happens within a relationship with a person, because the ability to consent to something bigger, to society, something so different and so nebulous. But, like, when you're, like, with your family or your friends or your partner or, and like, your kids, this is a relationship where the power bonds always shift. Like you said, like, when I was a kid, I was totally dependent on my parents. I'm not dependent on them now, but they might be dependent on me one day.
Yeah.
It's not something that is static. And because of it, it's so hard to, like, pinpoint any answers. It's mind-boggling that we live in this, like, network of power structures that are almost invisible to us. We never think about them unless something goes wrong, basically.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Last year on the show, Carissa Chen was talking about her debut novel, Homeseeking. I loved, loved the book, and so did the judges at the Cabell First Novelist Award. They've just put her book on the short list for the prize. Congratulations, Carissa. Listen to our episode with Carissa Chen wherever you get your podcasts or on NHPR.org. My guest today is Bar Friedman-Tell, and we are talking about her brand new debut, Honeysuckle. This novel is twisted and unhinged in all of the absolute best ways. It is a dark fantasy about love and power, autonomy and consent. If you loved Frankenstein, you will love Honeysuckle. We've been talking up until now about love and possession, and I think that this lens of a fairy tale that you've used, Bar, in your debut novel, Honeysuckle, makes it so much more approachable. Like, we can get there and talk about when does someone become their self, you know, does love and dependence, how are those interconnected? We can do that through this lens of a fairy tale because it's not real. You know, did you find that that was easier for you too?
Yes, I think this is one of the really incredible things about using fantasy or fantasy elements is that it enables us to look at things that are uncomfortable for us or that we're tired of looking at and like doing it from a different angle in a way that makes it easier. And the way that the fantastical can function both as the thing itself and as a metaphor is one of the most fascinating things and one of the things I love most. And I'm sorry, you can see that I spent way too many years in the English department.
I mean, I love it. You're talking to someone who also has. This is, I am your people. I think all the listeners are too, right? If you're listening to Check This Out, you are a literature or book person. Let's talk about, there is, I'm going to call it a created lover's trope. There is a school of literature in which somebody makes a person who becomes their lover, right? The classic would be Frankenstein, which has been warped many times into a romanticized version. Or my other favorite is Helen Wecker's The Golem and the Genie. I loved those books. What is so compelling to people about this created lover idea?
That's a really good question. I think in every mythology, there's at least one type of like, let's create our own husband or wife, usually wife. And I think it's part the fantasy of the perfect partner and part really, really wanting to be able to control the person we love, really wanting to be able to say, this is what I want and this is what you'll be. Like, not only create, but also curate the perfect partner. This fantasy is also something that I feel blocks us from like seeing the person in front of us in many ways if we fall into it too much.
It's like, yes, it's this tension between you want the perfect partner, the perfect love, and yet it's not possible. And I think maybe that's part of the exploration is that you can't control what you ultimately love the most, you know, and that's tragic.
It is. And I think also that, like, if you want the perfect person, you don't want a person. You want a reflection of yourself, a reflection of your needs. And that's not a relationship. That's a conversation with ChatGPT.
Right. That doesn't exist. Oh, my God. We are definitely on going down that road of created lovers through ChatGPT. That's coming. So in this book, in your debut, Honeysuckle, we have a brother and sister, Rory and Wynne, who have created Day. She's a flower girl based on the Welsh myth, Bloodywood. And she basically disintegrates every season. She has to be rebuilt every season because like the flowers, they change every season. And there's something very violent in that. It's not just like she lays down and closes her eyes and goes to sleep and dies, right? I mean, she literally cracks and turns to dust and her ankles break. Pieces of her are falling apart. It's very violent. Why is this part of violence in there as a part of this fairy tale and this created lover's trope?
I think part of it is just because the reality of seasons is pretty violent. When you look at it like flowers die. When you think about the end of autumn, the way like the world changes from this vibrant, insanely red, gorgeous thing to a bunch of sticks and brown, there's something very inherently violent about it, or at least very stark. But I also think I really wanted to explore a dynamic where the dependence is continuous on both sides, and where he has to continue deciding making her. Because, for example, the way Frankenstein explores it is you create someone, and then you really explore the question of, like, was it okay to create them? What is your responsibility for the thing you created? But the thing created is a fact existent in the world separately from you. And I really wanted to explore what happens when it's a decision you have to make every 3 months, both for Day to be so dependent on someone, but also for Rory, whose sister created Day for him, and what it means to know that, like, if he breaks his hand, his best friend dies, or later the person he's in love with dies, or if he won't come back in time from the city, she will die, and what kind of toll it creates when her life is literally in his hands all the time, and what choices it forces both of them to make.
The choices are really fascinating, because Rory's obsession with Day definitely ramps up throughout the book, right? It starts off with an 8-year-old boy who just loves to play with her all the time. Then he falls completely in love with her, and he has to decide how literally to make her body into a woman's body so that he can be with her. And then we see him obsessing, like you were saying, over every, you know, season he has to come back and remake her or she will die. You know, and he's just like obsessed with this to the point that he creates a magical sort of bubble around the house and the woods where she lives, that where it's perpetually spring. I mean, this obsession just keeps growing and in a sense making Day's prison more oppressive and larger in a sense, and smaller at the same time, right? Because she can't escape his obsession and his control over her. Let's talk about that, the ramping up of his obsession that creeps up in the book. How did you approach that?
First of all, I don't think I could have written Rory without loving him, which I know is a very controversial thing to say because readers have very strong opinions about him. And that's wonderful. That's what I want. But for me as a writer, I couldn't have written it without understanding him and loving him. From Rory's angle, I was really exploring what it means to have someone so dependent on you when you never got the choice. Like, he didn't make the choice to create her. He didn't make the choice to have someone dependent on him. And the way his anxiety, like, ramps up as he realizes, okay, forever now, if I want her to exist, I need to be the one doing it. So, as you said, he starts obsessing about how to make her be independent, how to make her live longer, how to save her, basically. And along the way, the line between saving her and making himself less anxious and controlling her starts to blur dramatically. And, like, he's really good intentions. He keeps trying to excuse his actions by, like, really trying to help Day and making her independent. And I think part of what I'm doing is, like, at what point do you not believe the good intentions anymore? Or at what point the good intentions are not enough?
That right there is it. At what point are good intentions not enough? I think that for me, that was the core of your debut novel, Honeysuckle. At what point are those good intentions not enough? Because there's no question that Rory, in his heart, loves Day, the flower girl that has been created for him. But his actions are, in some senses, reprehensible, right? But it comes from a good intention. And how do you balance that as the writer? How do you balance that and keep writing through that?
As I said, I think the only way is to write something, someone you can love and understand while going down roads that I would never, ever choose to see a person go down or condone.
Yes.
Like, please don't do that.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out on New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Bar Fried-Medtel, and we are talking about her brand new debut novel, Honeysuckle. We are talking about the Flower Girl Day, who was created by Rory and Wynn throughout this book. And Rory falls in love with her. She's completely dependent on him. She's made by him. And Rory's friends and sister even start to tell him, this is bad. They're like, man, you got to stop, right? She's not real. She's a flower girl. Why don't you fall in love with a real woman or have a relationship with a real person? And he can't see that, what they're trying to show him, that there's a problem, and they can't get through to him. And that also seems very real in the larger world where people try to tell people they love that they're going off the rails, they're doing something wrong. Let's talk about that reflection and how people are trying to help him with a problem he doesn't recognize.
I think each one of the characters in Honeysuckle that are not Rory, and they have a very different perspective on their relationship. Like Rory's sister, Wynn, is convinced that they is not a person, that Rory is treating his basically his imaginary playmate as his like forever person. But she also recognized that she created this mess. And slowly starts to not quite take responsibility, but at least be involved enough to say, what you're doing is wrong. Please stop. While his friends, some of them are like, we're your ride or die. We're with you, whatever you're doing. Like, we have your back, as friends sometimes do, even when you're in the most questionable of relationships and doing the most questionable of actions. And we love friends for that. But also some of them are like, you created a pet and what you're doing is morally wrong. You need to stop now. Part of it is to show that there's never like one perspective or one right answer. But also like the lengths we will go to convince ourselves that we are right and what we think is right and how adept we are as humans and just ignoring the things that don't sit with the way we see the world. But we are such amazing storytellers, all of us, in the story we tell ourselves about our lives. And it's really hard to break through it.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. One of the big themes in your debut novel, Honeysuckle, is loneliness. Day is created because Rory is lonely. And we see throughout the novel that Day is lonely. She misses Rory when he goes off to school and he leaves for a week or two at a time. Let's talk about loneliness. Why is that the theme? And how did you think about that?
I think part of it is just me being really fascinated by loneliness, because I feel like loneliness, a lot of it is like feeling constantly the whole of a different person, because you can be alone and not feel lonely. But loneliness is like a whole shape and like the person you want to be there. It's an absence, basically. And I don't know why I'm so fascinated by it. I think part of it is because I think loneliness is one of the moments where we can really see ourselves or like different pieces of ourselves, because so much of us exists in relation to other people. And so much of us is the way we're reflected from other people. And feeling lonely is a moment where you don't have any reflections and you have to figure out like how to reflect yourself, how to learn to see yourself not through the eyes of other people. And it's extremely painful, but it's also a moment where you can like be yourself as much as such a thing is possible for social creatures.
That's so true. Bar, let's talk about the title of your debut novel, Honeysuckle. Why choose that title? What role does Honeysuckle play in your debut?
So the real and slightly embarrassing answer is that names are the bane of my existence. It extends also to naming books. I hate it deeply. So Honeysuckle had a very bad name that will never be disclosed. And then my brilliant, brilliant agent came up with this brilliant name. And I went and opened a dictionary of flowers, which is the thing that like 18th and 19th century England and Europe had, like the language of flowers, and discovered that honeysuckle means the bonds of love. And it was so perfect that I was like, okay, yes, that is the name.
Perfect. And honeysuckle is used to make day.
It's a specific component in the creation. It actually is used to bond a blue day with to her creation, which is a play on the meaning.
I thought it was a perfect title. Bar Friedman-Tell, thank you so much for joining me today on Check This Out.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Next up, the book biz. This is where we look at the forces shaping what gets written, published, and read today. We are talking about the future of book criticism with former Washington Post book critic Ron Charles. For decades, book critics helped decide which books broke through, which writers mattered, and what readers paid attention to. But that world might be changing. Reviewers don't seem to sell books the way they once did. Newspapers are shrinking their coverage, and readers are increasingly finding their books through Instagram, BookTok, and podcasts. So I want to ask today on the Book Biz segment, do book reviews still matter? And if critics no longer drive the conversation around books, who does? I am so excited to be joined today by Ron Charles. I mean, I don't know who else to ask these questions to in the world. He is a longtime book critic at The Washington Post. Ron, welcome to Check This Out.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really delighted to be here.
My folks live in New Hampshire. My dad was born and raised there. He still owns the farmhouse in Potter Place, New Hampshire, which is about 10 miles down from New London in Andover. We go up there every summer and spend a few weeks with them. There's a little literally a little covered bridge across the road from their house.
I love that. So as I said in the intro, for decades, the Washington Post or the New York Times could really shape a book's future. Is that still true?
Definitely not. The most recent thing that happened, of course, is the Washington Post closed its book section. So it's not commenting on books anymore. Of course, the Times still has a vibrant book section. The Wall Street Journal has a great book section. The LA Times, out in Chicago, there's a good book section. So critics are still out there. The New Yorker still reviews books. The London Review of Books. The Guardian has a great book section. It's still there. But you're definitely right. Most people are not making their buying decisions according to book reviews. But that doesn't mean they aren't important. I mean, they have had other utility besides that. I mean, they do contribute to the cultural conversation around books and big ideas. And if you think of books as that part of our culture which is most prepared, most stewed, most considered, we do need people to pay attention to them, because otherwise all we're paying attention to are the things that, you know, happened in the last 10 minutes.
I mean, I personally agree with you. I think that in-depth coverage and criticism of books is crucial to the overall conversations around the world. But if these sections are closing, like the Washington Post closed, right, their book coverage, and people aren't really reading it anymore, how are we still going to have that out there?
Well, its reach was never very wide, let's face it. The book review section was always, you know, the least read section of most papers. It was always something refined. It was always like live theater. You know, everyone's going to movies and sports, and then a few people go to live theater. That doesn't mean we shouldn't have live theater, or that doesn't serve any purpose. So I think it's easy to exaggerate the influence that book reviews once had and then mourn its loss. But they were always pretty niche, let's face it.
I don't know. I mean, so as someone who's published with Hachette, I've been in the traditional publishing industry. My novel Atomic Anna was on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, right? And it did, right, that coverage got me into a lot of conversations and a lot of people's hands that it would not have been in without that.
Yes.
Now, it wasn't enough to move the needle and make me write one of these super hot bestsellers, but it did do something for me.
Oh, it does do something, but the Times is pretty unique. In most markets, a good book review, you know, will only sell a few dozen copies, maybe a few hundred at tops. And as you noted of your own personal experience, that's not a way to wealth and early retirement. But there is still this whole group of people, and they include authors and publishers, who need to have a conversation about what's important, what's well done, what's schlock, and that will continue.
And how do you think that's going to continue in the future? Where are we going to see it?
There are the newspapers and magazines that I mentioned. It still goes on Goodreads. I mean, I'm really surprised. I go on Goodreads and there'll be some 800-word review by somebody who's, you know, anonymous or nobody ever heard of this person. And they've spent a lot of time crafting a very thoughtful, enthusiastic review. And I applaud that sort of democratization of book criticism that's taken place over the last 20 years. Because for a long time, you know, it was just a few people deciding, you know, what got attention. And now I think it's great that lots and lots of new people have entered that conversation. You mentioned book talk. I mean, let's face it. Women have always been driving the fiction market since the beginning. They're doing it now again. Young women on TikTok, what they like with their enthusiasm. I think that's a wonderful thing. And to denigrate it, one would be just sort of reenacting the same pejorative attitudes we had about women's tastes, you know, in the previous century or in the 19th century when Hawthorne talked about that, you know, that army of scribbling women. But these are the people that have always established literary taste in our culture.
What I struggle with, I love that you're saying that, by the way, and recognizing it, because I think a lot of people don't. And a lot of people that I come into contact to in the literary world poo-poo a lot of Bookstagram. But the fact is that there are some very thoughtful ideas and criticisms on there. But I mean, I still love the traditional book review. For example, you reviewed Janet Edwards' book, Canticle, and she was on the show. And you did such a deep dive into that and helped me see it in ways that I hadn't thought about when she was on the show. And that conversation, I think, is important. But if people aren't reading print, and that trend continues, we're going to see more and more book reviews going out of print. How do we replace that? I mean, I keep coming back to this question because I don't want to see it happening.
Well, thank you, first of all. I'm glad you enjoyed that review. The day I was laid off, I moved to Substack, and I'm still doing exactly the same work on Substack. I have tens of thousands of readers. I still review a book every week, just as I did for the Post. I still write about publishing every Friday. There are these new platforms. A lot of us are moving on to them. We are finding audiences. It can still happen, but it's not going to be the way it was. And I agree, it's lovely to sit down on Sunday and have a book review laid out in a newspaper. But, you know, nobody under 65 gets a newspaper anymore. So it's silly to think that these things are going to be preserved if no one's going to buy it.
I find it so refreshing that you are so realistic, right, about this is what's happening.
Well, being laid off will make you realistic.
I guess it will, but there are still people in denial. And I just keep asking, like, what is the future of a literature class in a liberal arts college if we don't have a robust literary criticism machine out there?
That is a bigger and much more depressing question. I just read in the paper yesterday that one college a week is closing in America. You can bet the departments that are closing fastest are English, art history, philosophy, those sort of things. Yeah, that really does trouble me. And then we have to get into the effects of AI. And then, you know, by that time, I just want to go back to bed.
But at least we have your Substack. So we can at least be going back to that. I think, you know, publishing, just as criticism, right, traditional criticism is changing, publishing is also changing, right? It used to be that you would see the best books coming out of the Big Five or whoever, the traditional publishers. And now you see real space for indies and even self-publishing.
Right.
How is that playing a role in all of this?
It's tough because there are just too many books being published. The traditional publishers probably publish 65,000 books a year. The indie publishers, you know, another 100,000. The self-publishing, no one even knows. It could be as much as 4 million a year. These are just way too many books for the number of readers we've got in this country. So as the number of readers has slowly declined, steadily declined, the number of books being published keeps going up. I mean, we are reaching a point at which there are more people writing books than reading them. And that is really troubling to me. How do you find this issue of discoverability, which is the publisher's big challenge? How do you find a reader for that book which you have produced if no one's out there reading them and recommending them? Publishers should have much earlier spent time cultivating book reviews around the country. Instead, all they did was wring their hands, pour all their advertising dollars into the New York Times, and then throw up, you know, and mourn every time another book section around the country closed. Well, what did they think would happen?
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting, this question of discoverability. This show, Check This Out, is devoted to emerging writers, to finding new voices. And I get so many pitches a day
Oh.
That I can't read them all. I must be missing some amazing books. And I always feel horrible when I do.
Yeah. And you get these pleas, right? I'm sure they say, well, if you just read one chapter. But if you're getting 400 pleas a day, each of them says, if you just read one chapter, it just cannot possibly be done. I mean, at the Post, we had a pretty good section. It was 9 people. You know, it's pretty, I think it was the second largest section of the country. But we couldn't deal with the self-published books. Were there good ones out there? Of course, I'm sure there were. You know, Walt Whitman was independently published. We can name all kinds of great books that were self-published, but how do you find them? And you can't take the author's word for them because no author has ever published a book that she didn't think was the best in the world. So how are you going to get through this pile?
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out on New Hampshire Public Radio, and we are talking to Ron Charles. That's right, the one and only Ron Charles, book reviewer, formerly of The Washington Post. We are touching on the subject of discoverability. And how do you, Ron, decide what books you're going to review on your new Substack?
That's changed considerably. At The Post, you know, I had my editors, I had my colleagues who would constantly be looking for me and diving into things and reading Publishers Weekly and Kirkus and getting pitches from publishers. And so they would feed me all this information and we would make, you know, intelligent choices about what was out there and what should be reviewed. We were reviewing about 20 books a week. But now that I'm on Substack every week, I'm just reviewing one book a week and I have to, and it's my livelihood. I have to attract an audience. I cannot be as noble as I wanted to be at The Post. I have to review books that I know people are going to want to read about. And that does change the equation.
That makes a whole different kind of book review.
Yeah, exactly. Ann Patchett has a book coming out. I've got to review it. I love Ann Patchett. Most people do. You know, that's where I want to be, is where the conversation is. Can I go out and find, you know, new authors? Yeah, once in a while I can do that. But that can't be my bread and butter because there's no bread or butter there.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like we are at an inflection point in publishing and criticism. And I guess I'm old enough now that I was, you know, I studied with those majors no one's studying anymore, literature, philosophy, art, history. That was my core undergraduate education. Literature and philosophy was my major. You know, I don't want to see it going away. And I also recognize at the same time that I can't just fight the tide, right? That if it is going away, I can't be the only person to say, no, no, no. Like at some point, I've got to get in and decide, well, how can I help change this course more towards what I want it to be like? And I find this to be so, I don't know, I'm not really sure what to do about that.
My hope is that this is cyclical. That we go in and out of moments of high culture and low culture, that with the closing of Book World at the Washington Post, other new forms will develop. For instance, the first time Book World closed about 10 years ago, the Washington Independent Review was born, you know. And you can look at, say, the Paris Review and other things that popped up in answer to a perceived need. And I think that will continue to happen. And there will always be a high culture. There will always be thoughtful people. There will always be great books. It's just that the unusual thing now is that there are so many books, and that is historically unique.
Yeah.
We did not used to publish 4 million books a year. That's crazy.
Right. But at the same time, I love Book Talk and Bookstagram. I mean, it is so much fun to see people getting on there, and they love the books that they post.
Yeah. And what's wrong with that? I mean, why did enthusiasm get such a bad reputation in book criticism? I mean, I've been made fun of, and I don't mind. But, you know, I like to recommend books. I like to find books that I love, and I like to tell people I love them. And I hope that other people love them, too. And that seems to me like a perfectly legitimate kind of criticism that I do. I also respect other kinds of criticism that are, you know, perhaps a little more thoughtful or less enthusiastic. That's fine. But I think we can have a whole spectrum of tones and approaches to books. And, you know, they are largely young women expressing their enthusiasms for books. I think that's a great thing. I mean, look at this culture and the way reading seems to be fading away as, you know, other kinds of entertainment take over. Why shouldn't we celebrate young people who are literally crying over a book that they loved and were moved by?
Yes, but I want to push back on that because I don't think reading is fading away. I mean, look at all of the readers on Bookstagram and look at all of the money, the advertising, the right. The publishers are trying to go in there and they're trying to snap up the those writers, right? And then we see them on the bestseller list. H.M. Wolfe, who wrote Daggermouth, was a guest. She was scooped up in a seven-figure deal after selling over 30,000 copies of her own book in self-publishing and going through Bookstagram.
That is fantastic. And that, of course, is the rock star moments that all authors dream of.
Yes, yes. It almost never happens.
No.
And yet we have this reader-propelled success and this book just selling so many copies.
Yeah, but, and I don't want to be the downer here, but the National Endowment for the Arts does do, you know, pretty rigorous polling and collects data about how much people are reading. I think they do it every 5 or 10 years. And it's, you know, it's down, 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 down.
No. I'm sticking to Bookstagram and I'm believing that there are more people reading. So lots of people talk about Amazon and the algorithm and how that, you know, is a great way to find new books. And it's always recommending books. And I am dying to ask you, Ron Charles, formerly of The Washington Post, what is it that a critic or a book section can do that that algorithm cannot do for people looking for a book to read?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not a good way to find books to read because, I mean, look, I remember making fun of that years ago because every time I went on Amazon, it told me to read The Kite Runner. No matter what I was looking for, The Kite Runner, The Kite Runner. You know, it's just the tyranny of the bestseller list all over again, right? You get on that list, it's very sticky, you never fall off, it crowds out other books. So this is a real benefit of book reviews, is that they can push your taste beyond that list, beyond the algorithm, beyond that stack of, you know, recommended new fiction when you walk into Barnes & Noble. And I don't blame people. I mean, you go into a Barnes & Noble, what, there are maybe 65,000 titles there? Of course, your first reaction is just to be completely overwhelmed. And so you just go to the greeting cards or the puzzles because you just can't imagine wandering through this enormous store. So I love the idea of book reviews being able to push people gently toward adjacent tastes, things that, you know, are not so bizarre that they will just shut down and stop reading, but are just close enough to their taste to push them into something new. That's what a great book review can do.
If you're just joining me, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out on New Hampshire Public Radio, and I am talking to Ron Charles, book critic. Ron, 10 years from now, how and where will readers discover books? Look into your crystal ball for me.
10 years from now.
10 years. What's your prediction?
Boy, that is wild. I do think we're going to see another substantial book section because I've talked to people about it. I know plans were in the works in different parts of the industry. So I do think there'll be another attempt.
You mean at a major newspaper?
Or magazine. I don't know how social media will evolve. It's so toxic now. I just, and book talk could fade into something else. I really, it's hard to imagine. 10 years ago, I never would have imagined this, right? I couldn't have imagined that I'd be working on writing every week on Substack. So I think 10 years is just too far.
So my big question for you then is authority shifting in the book criticism world?
Oh gosh, yes. As it should, right? I mean, not too long ago when I was in college, all we did was read books by white guys named John. Yes, we really, that was long overdue. And that happened, you know, thankfully, a couple decades ago. Now all kinds of people tell their stories, people of all races, people around the world, people of different backgrounds, different classes. We just have a much, much richer literature than we did before. That's a great thing. I mean, it's a rich, diverse country.
Ron Charles, thank you so much for joining me here on Check This Out.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels Abandon the Stars and Atomic Anna. You have been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by C&S Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books we're talking about this season. Thank you so much for listening. Read on.